Please attend the floor. The Honorable Court of Appeals of the State of New Mexico.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning, everyone. You're with us today. We are here on the matter of the State of New Mexico versus Monique Martinez, case number A1CA41901. Counsel.
Mary Barquette on behalf of Monique Martinez.
Michael Thomas for the State of New Mexico, Raul Torres, Attorney General. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Barquette, are you reserving any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes. May it please the court. Rule 11704, allowing testimony to embrace ultimate issues, permits parties to present expert testimony which is necessary to educate and assist the jury in its difficult task of determining guilt or innocence. This rule is not meant to allow witnesses to take that determination away from the jury or to taint the jury's determination with unduly prejudicial testimony. So if we are taking this opportunity to clarify the law in this area, and I think it's a good opportunity to take, I think we actually need to get back and address some of the basic issues that tend to get overlooked or glossed over in our discussions. Why ultimate issue testimony is so problematic in the first instance, what constitutional concerns underlie its limitation, and what rules of evidence govern its admissibility. I think these are necessary so that we can articulate a coherent approach based on constitutional rights, the rules of evidence, and our cases. So what is the problem with this testimony? Expert testimony that someone is guilty is highly prejudicial. This is dynamite testimony to a jury. Pires and Kane talk about jurors being likely to defer to expert assessments. And I think for assessments of guilt in particular, they're likely to defer to experts for both logical and emotional reasons. So I think it's doubly potent in this context.
What is the testimony that the defendant is guilty by the expert? What did the expert say exactly?
The expert in this case testified that the defendants were trafficking.
Did he say that expressly?
He testified that there was trafficking coming out of the house, that in review, or coming out of the hotel room in which there were just two people.
What's your reference site for that?
I think I actually do quote the testimony in the briefing. So,
on page four.
Yeah, on page four. And I think they said there was trafficking of methamphetamine coming out of the hotel room. And then they asked if this was for personal use or distribution. And he said, I'm sorry, I believe that what I found collectively was evidence of trafficking methamphetamine. And then later on, taking into account all the evidence in the case, not the isolated evidence that was her purse, what's your opinion as to the amount of methamphetamine? It was being used for trafficking. And then later on, when he's talking about why he didn't send this off for DNA analysis, he didn't feel it was necessary, though he sometimes does in cases with multiple people in the house. He didn't hear because he said, I try not to bog them down with that. I believe I have enough evidence in this case to charge the defendant with trafficking.
Does it matter that the question or the testimony was, what would your opinion?
I think it does because it makes it very clear it's his expert opinion that these people are guilty of trafficking. This is his expert assessment. He's an expert in trafficking saying, I think the people in this case are guilty of trafficking.
I was just going to follow up and say, how should he have said it to make it permissible?
I don't think he should have said it at all. I don't think it was permissible testimony. I think the testimony he gave prior to that, when he talks about the significance of the physical evidence in the case, when he goes through and says, this is how you see it packaged, you'll see baggies, and this is how they use the baggies. Sometimes you see wax paper because things can be sticky. So when he talked about what they use guns for in trafficking, amounts, all of that is fine. That is all necessary to educate the jury in its job of determining guilt.
We seem to have looking at Rael Gallegos and the cases that have come since Rael Gallegos, talking about this fine line for expert testimony, and when you're on the line and you're over. And Rael Gallegos was a case, and if you looked at the dissent in Taylor, which we asked him to come talk about, that's talking about how you can give examples to other trafficking cases, but you're not allowed to talk about this case, the facts in this case, and what they signify.
Right.
Can you speak to us about that?
Yes. So I think I agree with the dissent in Rennick, and I think it gives us a very clear approach to this. And it's an approach that's very consistent with what you see in Bolsonaro, what you see in Kane.
But Taylor appears to be an outlier in that regard.
It does. Taylor is an outlier in that regard, and that was the opinion Rennick, the majority opinion, relied on in Rennick. The primary issue in Taylor was actually suppression, and they talk about this issue in one paragraph. So to the extent we're relying heavily on an unpublished case that was primarily focused on something else, I think that was the first mistake the majority made in Rennick. But in terms of where the line is, I think the Rennick dissent is very clear. You get to talk about stuff that educates the jury. So you get to talk in generalities, you know, what is commonly found with trafficking, what amounts are commonly associated with trafficking, what amounts are associated with personal use, what's consistent with trafficking in terms of guns, the tools of the trade.
Is the expert allowed to say, with that in mind, it's my opinion that the amount at issue in this case is consistent with trafficking?
I think... not, because they're specifically talking about the amount in this case. I think they're allowed to talk about, in their experience generally, what amounts are consistent with trafficking. That is their job. Right. And so I we don't talk about 702 very often, but a lot of other cases and a lot of other states in their 704 approach talk about 702, and in particular, the helpfulness to the jury prong of 702. And they say this kind of testimony that just tells the jury how to rule, that just makes the legal determination for them, is not helpful to the jury. And I think on the one hand that's confusing because obviously this is very helpful to the jury. You're taking a load off of them. You're telling them how to rule, and you're doing it as an expert. So that from their perspective, it's helpful. But what they're talking about is it's not helpful to the jury doing its actual job, its constitutionally mandated job of determining guilt in that case.
So the use of the word indicative of or would be considered or consistent with, are there distinctions among those that you see?
I think when they're talking in generalities, it's okay to use that terminology. I think when they start getting very specific to that case and start saying, everything I see here is consistent with this, that then the line kind of disappears. And you kind of see this in some of the other cases. So I think in Watson and Lamera, which are both cited in the briefing, they sort of talk about how this is ultimately sort of a distinction without difference. If you're saying, I looked at everything in this case and it is completely consistent with trafficking, I don't feel that's very different than saying everything in this case leads me to believe it's trafficking.
So the key is the everything in this case, the references to the evidence in this case.
I think it's drawing their assessment of this case, and the closer you get to them weighing in on that assessment. But in Watson, they talk about how speaking in generalities doesn't necessarily fix the problem, because the jury, if they understand you're just talking about this case, if the hypothetical is so close to this case, they understand this is their assessment of the evidence in this case. It doesn't matter if you speak in generalities. So it's actually, I think, what we need to look at is the effect of these terms. So the context in which it comes up, but also would a reasonable jury understand them to be weighing in on the guilt or innocence of this defendant?
How would you write that?
In Watson, they talked about if they make a statement about their testimony or the conclusion of guilt, quote, necessarily follows from the expert's testimony. So
couldn't that be true even if the expert is saying drugs in an amount above this quantity, plus a scale, plus baggies, plus a gun, plus everything else, is indicative of trafficking, based on my experience, isn't that essentially doing the math for the jury anyway? So I'm not sure how to distinguish what you're saying in terms of what's okay and what's not okay.
Right. So I think the line we want to say is your job as the expert is to educate the jury. You get to talk about these pieces of evidence and their significance in general terms. Alberico also sort of says that you get to talk about consistent with. And so I think you get to do that. But the closer it gets to being a comment on the evidence in that case, and the more a reasonable jury would understand you're doing the job for them, that's the problem. So it will matter how much they do this. It matters how much they repeat it. It matters how directly they're talking about it. It matters whether they're saying in this case or if they're just if you go back to a lot of his testimony.
I have a question, right?
Okay.
Generally, as I understand it, my experience is that experts can testify to the ultimate issue, and they can use those squishy terms, consistent with, and all that. Why, in almost every other area of law, can they testify in that manner, but here be prohibited?
Well, I don't think they can in every other area of law. So a lot of times the areas where they're going to be more likely to talk more directly about things that embrace an ultimate issue, it's going to be technical, scientific, and medical, right? The less the jury is likely to understand this. And this gets back to the differing roles. As long as the jury is empowered, is capable of making the ultimate determination in a case, we have to be protective of their ability to do that.
And is your position that there's a problem with the officers playing sort of a dual role in this case as expert and witness to the events?
That is part of the problem. That is one of the reasons it's very prejudicial here. And you can see this, I think, United States versus Cruz and Lopez Medina both talk about the dual hat problem. And they specifically note one of the problems with it is they're testifying as an expert and also they were the investigating officer, right? So there's this implicit, they have superior knowledge. So it suggests that evidence outside the record known to them, but not necessarily to the jury, supports their position.
They are. It would be different if an officer who is not the investigating officer came in and served as the expert.
I think in to the extent that they would just be educating the jury about the significance of this evidence and what, you know, amounts are common for personal use in this area at this time. I think in his testimony, he even said in 2019 it was common to buy 3 to 5 grams. So to the extent they talk about it like that, I think it's fine. I don't think that empowers them to make an assessment. Jurors understand the difference between trafficking drugs and using drugs and being around people that do those things. That's not actually something they need a lot of guidance on in terms of they can tell if someone's selling or using. We're just around people doing those things.
I
just
have a question. State versus Ashley,
right,
which talks about law enforcement officers as a distinct group related actually to prosecutors and judicial officers to be permitted to give an ultimate opinion. How important, or is that an important legal consideration? You've been sticking to a straight analysis of Rule 11704 and Rule 11702 and how it's applied in every case.
This gets to sort of the constitutional underpinnings of these issues, but I agree. I think Ashley, which was the bigamy case where they essentially gave the hypothetical and then said, what do you think, what would be your determination? He said, this would be bigamy. And so Ashley is directly on point, but they don't have a lot of discussion in Ashley of why it's improper. They're just like, it's improper. It's clearly improper. It's improper because defendants have the right to a jury trial, right? They have the right to have their guilt determined by a jury of their peers, not a panel of the state's experts.
What about the statement that jurors are entitled to disregard opinion testimony if they choose to?
I don't think that fixes the problem. First off, in a very similar ultimate issue context, because credibility determinations are also ultimate issue testimony, it's just they're not ultimate issue guilt. But in that context, We still find error, even though we tell them you get to determine the credibility of witnesses. It doesn't nullify the fact that they are likely to defer to this. And this goes back to the prejudice discussion that I was getting into earlier. This is very persuasive evidence, both from a logical standpoint, these are people that know more, and from an emotional standpoint, because the dissent in Rennick kind of touches on this. It talks about how difficult these determinations are. We are asking them to sometimes sit through days of testimony and say, yeah, that wasn't enough. We are asking them to pass judgment on whether they think people are telling the truth or lying. And we are asking them to judge another person and determine if they're guilty of a serious crime. These are weighty, stressful decisions. And because of that, it must be such a relief when someone says, don't worry, I am an expert on this crime and these people are guilty of it. It must just really take the load off of them from an emotional standpoint.
I don't want to take you off the rails here. I do want to touch on preservation
yes.
before we run out of
right. time. Right. Go ahead.
We have a preservation problem
here. I think it's preserved insofar as they were very specific about what they wanted. They said, we want him qualified as an expert to testify to this in particular. Then the attorney goes through and does a voir dire.
Do you know what they actually said? You're saying to testify to this. Unfortunately, that was one of the parts of the FTR that was extremely
yes, this was not. This was out of that jurisdiction that they had to fix the FTRs. And I struggled with this trial as well. I have so many inaudibles in my notes.
Didn't they offer the expert
I'm sorry?
Wasn't the offer by the prosecutor
yes.
that the expert be admitted as
Yes, and be declared an expert in street-level narcotics trafficking and be allowed to render an opinion as to trafficking.
So
that's what they asked for.
A couple of the issues that I have
okay.
with the way this all unfolded and the objection that's ultimately made after the board hearing the expert.
Mm-hmm.
The objection was simply, I object. And
yeah.
the district court judge was the one to say, to his testimony today.
Yes.
And the attorney said, yes, Your Honor. At no point did the attorney alert the judge to the nature of the problem with the testimony. It was a very vague, unspecific objection.
Right. I do understand that. I think it could have been clearer. The judge, I will say, did, in admitting it, did reference Rule 11, 702, 703, and 704. So I think to that extent, the court was kind of on board with what this was.
Why isn't it a problem that for almost an hour before he was born here, he was giving opinion testimony about both trafficking in general and then the evidence in this case, including an opinion that all of the evidence in this case was indicative of trafficking without objection?
Right. I think it was a problem ultimately that he wasn't qualified as an expert for those purposes, because also some of that testimony is much more educational than an ultimate conclusion is.
If we determine that this is not a preserved error,
mm-hmm.
and we're evaluating it under the plain error standard, how do you win?
I think I win because I think this is plain error. The court did understand this was 702, 703, and 704 that was coming in. So the court understood the rules, and it was for such a specific purpose. It was so clearly to testify to his expert assessment in this case.
But the testimony really was directed at whether or not this was trafficking. The issue in the defense theory in the case, as argued during closing, was whether she was the one that was in possession of these items. So aren't those really talking to different parts of the charge?
Well, I think also in the closings, they both talked about, well, even it, because there was some suggestion that this is for two people's use, right? So the amount might be higher if there's two people using them. I think the prosecutor touched on that in their closing, and I think the defense touched on that in theirs. So that's a component of it. But also, the expert in this case did tie her into traffic.
You don't see the defense conceding. No. If the jury saw it as all within her possession, were there also was an accomplice instruction,
right?
That she was an accomplice with her boyfriend, that they lost. That wasn't a confession.
I don't think it was. And I think the expert's testimony in this case also really tied both of them into the trafficking. He, at one point, says, I didn't send this in for DNA because I thought I had enough to charge this defendant with trafficking. There's traffic. He says trafficking several times in his assessment of this case. And so I do think this rises to the level of plain error, even if it's not adequately preserved in this case. And
the focused on the post-admission of expert testimony portion of his testimony, that after he was voir dired and admitted as an expert, it really focused on that portion. Are you objecting to any part of the testimony that occurred?
I did try and reread the testimony, and I think there's a certain point where they say in a very generalized way, so what do you look for in trafficking? And he does talk about these kinds of things. I don't know that in a generalized sense that's a problem if he's just saying, what do I typically look for to distinguish between them? I do think that's getting very close to the line, and it probably should have been objected to. But
right before he was voir dired, about 5 minutes before he was voir dired, the prosecutor asked him, looking at all of the evidence in this case, something to that effect, and he said that's indicative of trafficking.
Okay, I did not note that, to be quite frank.
And so that's why I'm wondering whether the scope of your question matters, because if it's just the post-expert testimony, and we have a problematic testimony before then.
I think it has to be all of the testimony that's essentially a comment on the evidence, right? A comment on guilt. It's all the testimony saying there's guilt in this case. And to the degree that those were the most clearest instances of it and he had objected to it, that's what mostly gets discussed, because at that point it was very clear to the jury he was an expert in trafficking and he was giving his assessment of guilt in this case. So to the extent that the context in which some of the statements come up, I think in Palinguin, I can't pronounce that name, in that case makes very clear that context matters. Like what they're talking about. If they're talking more about their investigation and they make an offhand comment, we're maybe not going to give as much weight to it. But when they've been qualified expressly to give their diagnosis and their opinion of the evidence, I think it does. But to also talk about why I think in this case it rises to plain error, I think it does because there are constitutional concerns underlying this. This is the jury's right to determine this, and this wasn't a foregone conclusion case. Her association with the evidence was more tangential. She was not clearly the guilty party, and it was not clear that she was assisting. So to the extent the expert here does tie her into the trafficking and sort of says in his expert opinion, which again potentially touches on matters outside the record that the jury never sees, his assessment of guilt is going to carry a lot of weight here.
That there was trafficking happening out of that group, doesn't necessarily say that she or your defendant was engaged in that trafficking.
Yes, he said it was out of this room. In my opinion, this all the evidence here is methamphetamine trafficking.
But the search warrant was directed at the boyfriend. The boyfriend and an unidentified female. We didn't name her.
Right. But to me, that's why his expert assessment carries more weight, and he does tie her into the trafficking in his testimony. So I do think it matters in this case and that he does tie her into it. And also I do want to just touch on why I think clarification is particularly helpful. I do think our law is not necessarily clear on where all these objections should be coming from. We don't have a lot of cases talking about 702 being a basis for objection. The helpfulness to the jury examination that occurs in other cases, we really don't have that here, right? We don't talk about it's not helpful to just give legal conclusions. It's not helpful to say somebody's credible or not. It's not helpful. They don't consider that helpful because that takes the jury's job from them, and we want the jury to actually do their job. I also think 403, we do kind of throw it out sometimes, but to the extent we could be very clear, here is where we think the objections come from. Constitutional grounds in some cases, 702 will be a common one as it is elsewhere, and then 403 is the other common one. So it does help to have a little clarity, and there are cases elsewhere that are clear. They're like, you need to be objecting on these grounds. I think that would be excellent guidance for both judges admitting this testimony, acting as gatekeepers to know what to look out for, and for the parties themselves. So I hope there is some clarity for that. But in terms of, I guess, where the line is in educating the jury, again, I think they get to talk about the tools of the trade, sometimes jargon. Obviously, if there's specialized drug lingo, they get to talk about what some of that means. If it's schemes, they often get to talk about that. But once we've given them the pieces the jury needs to put it together, that's when the testimony has to stop. This is not an ultimate issue question that requires scientific background. It doesn't require a medical degree. It doesn't require an engineering degree. This is not technical. This is not scientific. This is not medical. The jury can tell, once you've educated them on these individual pieces of evidence, the jury can tell at that point, and we need to let them. That is their constitutional job. Thank you.
May it please the court. And I probably won't even use my full 30 minutes. I welcome the court's questions. But I just wanted to start with the fact that I think Judge Baca brought up a very good point, which is that and I think that the defendant wants to downplay it, which is, and cited at the answer brief, page 7, the state cited cases making it clear, and it's a foundational principle that we have to assume in almost any criminal trial, which is that the juries are presumed to follow the instructions. That's answer brief, page 7. And I think we need to be aware or be concerned about starting to get into an area where the rule 5-10 years from now is going to be, well, the juries are presumed to follow the instructions except for drug trafficking cases or this kind of case, because there's going to be a natural tendency once that door is open to start saying, well, the juries are presumed to follow the instructions except for these kind of cases. So I thought Judge Baca brought up a good point, that that's sort of a foundational principle there that we start with. And I think that...
Can I interrupt you there? In most cases, my experience is that where there's an expert who's testified, there's an instruction, 14-50-50 criminal instruction, that's given that directs the jury that you have received expert testimony and you're free to disregard it if you don't believe it.
Right.
I look for the record, in the record, I look at the jury instructions here, 14-50-50 wasn't given. So they were never given that information that they could disregard the expert's opinion.
Well, I think it somewhat relates to the preservation issue. I mean, the state argued that this was plain error, and without going into detail, the state's position is really that if you object to someone being qualified as an expert early on, that's not enough. If as the Judge Duffy kind of hinted, what if 45 minutes later, an hour later, you're concerned about the expert talking about, now granted, that's not the best example because experts can rely on hearsay, but you're concerned about the manner of the question, the form, oh, the judge, this is getting into the ultimate issue. Well, you've got to raise that then. You can't just say, oh, I objected an hour ago that he was an expert, so I'm covered now. But going back to your question, is that I think here that the defendant was free to ask for a limiting instruction. Why he didn't, I don't know. In the state's brief, I did cite to, it's an unpublished case, but the state v. Berry from New Jersey talks about how in this area, a lot of this can be solved by proper limiting instructions. And so an example of that would be the state agrees that if a prosecutor asks a witness, was defendant guilty of trafficking, that should warrant an objection if the defense attorney is doing a good job. Or if the prosecutor asks a witness, did defendant intend to distribute these drugs? Well, that should also warrant an objection. Now, granted, I understand Rule 704 says that the ultimate issue, the fact that it's touching on the ultimate issue is not per se a problem, but it's pretty clear that these are areas. In fact, one way to look at it is when you look at Rael, Gallegos, Taylor, and Rennick, the one they're a little bit all over the map, but the one thing they all seem to agree on, and I've got a few other cases, the Notice of Supplemental Authority, I cited a Michigan case and a California case I'll briefly talk about in a minute, But I think what they seem to agree on is it's more helpful to look at what are the one or two areas that everyone's pretty much in agreement you should not touch. And what I would say is, rather than get into the minutia of how did this person answer it in this case, how did they answer it in this case, some of the questions really touched on that good point, which is how it's phrased. It's hard. It really depends on how you're looking at it. Here, the expert was asked, in your opinion, based on your experience and your training, does this indicate trafficking? I think that reasonably could be viewed as him saying, it's my opinion it's trafficking, but nothing detracted or nothing hinted to the jury that this is not your ultimate role to determine. So I
pretty close. I mean, it's telling the jury, I believe this is trafficking. So, I'm not
going to tell you that. Yeah, especially when the statement is that it is trafficking. He doesn't couch it at all in terms of the soft, consistent with, or indicative of. He makes a pretty direct statement. Even though the question is, what's your opinion? The opinion can be that they're guilty. That's the problem, right?
And I understand that, but I don't think that what he said here really got into that ultimate area of, or the sort of that really the real problematic area of saying this person is guilty or they did have the intent. And I guess I got a little sidetracked, but to go back to Judge Baca's question, I think some of this can be solved by proper objections, and as the state, the Berry case from New Jersey says, as long as the district judge is aware, hey, we're getting into an area that could be problematic, there's certainly nothing wrong, and the defense attorney, perhaps at trial in this case, should have said, Judge, I want a limiting instruction, just reminding the jury that they can reject this expert's opinion. And I did want to note that
is this testimony over the line? And I'm looking at Rael Gallegos, paragraph 35, mm-hmm. where Sutton was talking about the line in that case, and he's talking about, he says, we acknowledge there's a line between one, testimony as to typical users and traffickers based on the amount of drugs in their possession, and here, testimony as to whether the amounts in the possession of the subject defendant indicated a purpose to traffic and not to use. So we're right on the line there, but once you go over the line, and he seemed to indicate that is over the line, it indicates the purpose to use or indicates the purpose to traffic, et cetera, that's where we run into trouble with the testimony itself. And then not what do we do with it after it's come out, but should it come in the first place?
And I understand that. And the state's only point is that probably in hindsight, the defense attorney should have asked for limiting instruction, but they didn't. I understand that.
About the way this case was presented by the prosecution.
Okay.
It's unusual to have qualification basically asked about first, all of his training and experience, and then all of the questions that are at least close to, if not fine, in terms of asking his opinion about, well, are scales used in trafficking and how, that sort of thing. And then, only then, qualifying him as an expert and then asking him only questions that relate to his ultimate opinion about the case. And in fact, when he tries to answer them in a more general way, saying, no, I really want to know, is this trafficking? Should we be considering that and analyzing plain error?
Yes, sure. And the state was also going to argue that given the fact of the scales and the baggies, that there's a good argument here that it's harmless error, which logically means it wasn't plain error. But I think that's a very good question, but I think it goes back to why it's important to have these timely objections at trial. A lot of this could have been solved, and I'm not faulting the defense counsel. I wasn't there at trial, but clearly it's important to have these timely objections, like making it clear, hey, I'm objecting to this person being qualified as an expert, or later on, okay, fine, I understand the court's ruling they're qualified as an expert, but judge, some of these questions, district judge, they're starting to get into this ultimate issue area. Hey, I think I'm going to want a limiting instruction to make it clear to the jury that they have the ability to reject that. And I just wanted to really quick point out 2 RP 403 to 404, the jury instructions did make it clear that the jury was the ultimate judge of facts and credibility. And one of the themes when you look at Rael, Gallegos, Taylor, and Rennick is really, in hindsight, was there anything said that really suggested to the jury in any way that anything was being taken away from them? And I don't see that here. If you look at Rael Gallegos, in paragraph 34, they make it clear, Sergeant Taylor's testimony did not detract from the jury's ability to independently draw conclusions based on all the evidence presented at trial. And there's a similar statement made in, I believe it's Taylor or Rennick. It's hard to remember every single case.
You referenced paragraph 34 and that statement that beginning of day, in paragraph 33, midway through that paragraph, it says, here Sergeant Taylor did not offer an opinion as to the ultimate issue of fact, that is, whether the defendant had an intent to distribute the cocaine to another. To the extent that her testimony embraced the ultimate issue by educating the jury in regard to what factors in her experience warranted a trafficking charge, it was nevertheless meaningless. So they're even pointing out the difference between giving education to the jury and testifying as to guilt.
You're right, and that's why I think paragraph 33 of Rael Gallegos probably needs some clarification, because when you look at paragraph 33, you're right. They start off saying, moreover, you know, basically they're saying we're acknowledging that Rule 704 allows experts to testify on matters, but then they make the statement that you just read, which is, it can be a little confusing to read, but then in the very next sentence they say, and that's why it is a little murky, in the next sentence they say, to the extent that her testimony embraced an ultimate issue by educating the jury, it says it was nevertheless admissible, and they cite Rule 704. So it's you're right. I mean, I think that's why it's good that the court is taking this up on oral argument, because it's been 13 years since Rael Gallegos, and maybe some of the ideal or correct understanding of the case has maybe drifted a lot in the state here and there. So it's a little unfair. So I think this is a really good opportunity for the court to address that.
Why isn't this testimony over the line?
I think partly it's because the way it was phrased, and I know this is why I think we don't want to get too much into the minutiae of what was said. It's better to stay away from these two areas. If you get into these areas, you're going to be on thin ice. Otherwise, you're okay. I would say when you look at the cases, that as long as you're not saying that, in my opinion, the defendant is guilty, or in my opinion, he or she had the intent to distribute, it's generally going to be okay. I mean, obviously, we have cases saying that intent is going to be inferred from the circumstances, but I think there's a tension here between, you know, the jury instructions being presumed to be followed, and then someone coming in after the fact and wanting to say, well, something went wrong, I was convicted, the jury must have been confused. Well, no, I mean, the jury had certainly a basis here to say scales, baggies. The other thing I wanted to say, too, is...
Sure. That throws me a little bit. Okay, so your position is, the line is, he's not allowed to say, in my opinion, this was what? In my opinion...
The requisite intent to distribute was there.
Right.
Or he or she is guilty, perhaps.
So when we get to the state's redirect of Officer Nordquist, the state asks, what's your opinion as to the amount of methamphetamine in this case? And Nordquist responds, it was being used for trafficking.
Right.
Isn't that a problem under your proposed framework?
I would say not, because he's expressing his opinion. He didn't say she's guilty, jury, you don't have to do anything, she's guilty, or your role is over. I guess I would say the way to look at it.
Is that the distinction, it is trafficking versus she was trafficking?
Well, not so much that that's the distinction, but he didn't say anything to suggest that your role is over. I mean, he's saying, in my opinion, it's trafficking, but he didn't say, jury, don't listen to the judge's instructions, your role is over. I mean, I'm not being facetious. I'm just saying that we have to give the jury faith and some credit that they're going to say, you know what, yeah, this guy said this witness said this, but we're not bound to follow that. Now, in this case, granted, it was just the Nordquist and the lab analyst. The defendant didn't testify. That's not my point, but the defendant didn't even call her own witness or expert to say, well, I was a police officer in L.A. for 20 years, and I don't believe this was trafficking. She could have called a witness. She wasn't prevented from doing that.
We keep talking about all the things the defense actual testimony that came out. And I realize that I understand the state taking the position, don't focus on the words.
Yeah.
But I think we got to focus on the words a little bit.
Well, to the extent that this court would find that saying that there was trafficking coming out of the hotel room or there was trafficking along those lines, the state would argue, A, it's not preserved. It doesn't raise grave doubts about the verdict. And, of course, plain error is to be applied sparingly. But part of that, I think, is that it really was harmless here because any reasonable jury would have very likely found her to be guilty of trafficking because she wasn't just in a room with paraphernalia and drugs. She was in a room with scales and baggies. And, unfortunately, she did get mixed up with this guy. If it had just been her in a room with drugs, probably she would have had a decent chance at a possession verdict. But when you're in a room with scales and baggies, you're really kind of in a situation where most people are going to say, yeah, you probably were trafficking.
How do you respond to the evidence wasn't unequivocal in favor of trafficking if this expert's testimony hadn't come?
I think without the expert, the jury probably would have still had enough. Certainly there's certainly an understanding that juries, and the cases have acknowledged this, that the juries sometimes do need some help because, let's face it, we have to almost assume most jurors don't have a background in how drugs are trafficked and that sort of thing. So it's natural that they're going to need a little bit of guidance on that issue.
Well, that was really my question because I heard counsel for the defense say that jurors don't need this kind of testimony to help them. I think I've read in cases and even just life experience that not everybody is acutely aware of what's trafficking and what's personal abuse. And so I think that it is helpful for a jury to have this kind of testimony. Would you agree?
I do agree. In fact, just to cite it super quick, it's not directly relevant here, but in State v. Ryder, 1996 New Mexico Court of Appeals 077, that case concerned 404B evidence, so it's not directly applicable. But in that case, there was a dissent by Judge Hartz, and one thing, and I'm not going to read much of it, but in that dissent by Judge Hartz, he notes that a competent prosecutor will not unnecessarily rely on the credulity or speculation of the members of the jury. This is paragraph 22 of State v. Ryder. So it's understood most jurors aren't going to understand how trafficking works. They're going to need a little bit of guidance. But the way the state looks at it is ultimately, at the end of the day, was there anything to suggest to the jury that, oh, despite what the district judge is telling us in the instructions, we have to go with this expert? Well, there was nothing really suggesting it. In fact, I wanted to read something super quick from Rennick. In Rennick, paragraph 22, paragraph 22 of Rennick talked about, you know, they talk about Detective Jones' testimony, but in paragraph 22 of Rennick, they say, allowed the jury to weigh the testimony as it saw fit in determining whether defendant intended to traffic methamphetamine. So even in Rennick, there's sort of an underlying recognition of, sure, if the prosecutor makes an argument in closing or anything like that that might suggest, oh, you have to listen to this expert, then you might say, okay, this is going too far. We understand the juries are presumed to follow the instructions, but hey, prosecutor, you went over the line by telling the jury they had to listen to this expert. But in Rennick, and I read it earlier, a statement from Gallegos, as long as there's really nothing that overtly is telling the jury, oh, your job is over, you have to listen to this expert, we have to assume that they followed the instructions.
What I'd like to get back to Judge Baca's question about the fact that the jury instructions did not include the instruction that an expert's testimony can be disregarded entirely by the jury. You're arguing that it only would have been error if they were affirmatively instructed that they had to follow the expert's testimony. What about the omission of the instruction that they don't have to in New Mexico follow the expert's testimony or find it credible?
Yeah, and I don't. To be honest, I don't know why that wasn't given here. I mean, really, I understand the value of any case where you have an expert, such as the case like this. I don't see that anybody would object to a limiting instruction to the jury telling them, you know, you're not bound by the experts. Ultimately, as the other record proper site for the instructions mentioned, it's up to you. I don't know why that wasn't given here.
And I think it's especially important where in Gallegos and some of the cases that follow that the courts talk in terms of, okay, maybe there are some, the evidence is prejudicial and points towards guilt, but But we look to cross-examination, maybe a counter expert and all of that sort of stuff, and the instruction. And especially in this case where the crux of the case is this expert to not have given 14-50-50 seems to me to be, I'm not quite sure why it wasn't given, especially, and I just want to put it in the record, 14-50-50 says you should consider each opinion received in evidence in this case and give it such weight as you think it deserves. If you should conclude that the reasons given in support are sound, or that for any other reason an opinion is not correct, you may disregard the opinion entirely. That seems like a very important instruction to give and to have forgotten about in this kind of case.
The state's position is, you're right. I don't know why Judge Baca wasn't given here. I don't know. Maybe at trial they thought that again, 2RP 403 to 04, maybe they thought the baseline instructions about the jury is the ultimate judge of facts and credibility. I don't know, and I don't even remember if it was mentioned in the other side's brief how it even came up at all. I don't know why that wasn't given.
As I was preparing for the case, I looked at the jury instructions, and from, expert instruction, and expected it to be there, and it wasn't.
Yeah, and again, I think that just loops back to the preservation. And I'm not, just to be clear, I'm not faulting anybody at trial how they tried it. I mean, they try a lot of cases, and it's very quick. And I maybe in the hindsight, that's part of what needs to be made clear is you need to give this instruction anytime there's an expert. I did, and I welcome any more questions. I just wanted to really super quick hit a few highlights of a few other cases I found. One case that's worth noting, and I wanted to just preface it with saying that first, the federal rule, and the other side's brief did mention that the federal rule is a little different, and so that's understanding. We're understanding that that some of the federal cases are not necessarily going to be apples and oranges with this. But just to note that the federal rule 704A says, and it basically reads exactly like the New Mexico rule, an opinion is not objectionable just because it embraces an ultimate issue. Now, 704B has an exception that says in a criminal case, an expert witness must not state an opinion about whether the defendant did or did not have a mental state or condition that constitutes an element of the crime charged or of a defense. Now, those matters, and it even says those matters are for the trier of fact alone. And it's not important why that arose, but I was reading about it. And although the federal rules were enacted in 1975, apparently B was added because after the Reagan assassination attempt with Hinckley, there was a thought that you had too many people saying this is their state of mind, and so they said, okay, in criminal cases, you cannot go to that. That's ultimate issue for the jury. But it is interesting that the Supreme Court sort of touched on this, and I think it's relevant enough to mention. I did not cite this in a notice of supplemental authority, but in Diaz v. United States, that's 602 U.S. 526, 2024, at pages 532 to 533. But the issue in that case was someone was coming across the border, they had drugs in their car, and she claimed, I had no idea these drugs were in the door. So the issue was whether she knew the drugs were there. So in Diaz, a law enforcement expert testified about the knowledge of most drug couriers, explaining that most drug trafficking organizations are not going to allow drugs to be transported by an unknowing courier. And this is, again, 602 U.S. at 530. So this is all 530 to 533. And they explain in there that the reason why is because a drug trafficking organization is going to view it as it's too much risk if I say person A, I'm going to have them transport drugs unknowingly. There's too much risk of loss. And then I've got the problem when they get to their destination, how do I get my drugs back without them knowing about it? So the expert testifies about the fact that it's very unusual for there to be an unknowing drug courier. Well, the defendant in that case contended that the expert's opinion violated Federal Rule of Evidence 704B, which says you cannot address the mental condition of the defendant. That's for the trier of fact. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected defendant's claim of error, noting that the law enforcement agent did not express an opinion about whether Diaz herself knowingly transported methamphetamine. And in a key passage, the U.S. Supreme Court said the following, while Agent Flood provided evidence to support one theory, his testimony was just that, evidence for the jury to consider or reject when deciding whether Diaz in fact knew about the drugs in her car. Because Agent Flood did not give an opinion about whether Diaz herself did or did not have a mental state or condition that constitutes an element of the crime charged or of a defense, his testimony did not violate 704B. So it shows that even though the federal rule is more restrictive, the Supreme Court still said this is no problem. I don't think that's a bad way to look at them, but I also think there's not only in Diaz, but there's language in Livingston or Lindbergh where they make it clear that ultimately this was the jury's determination, and it's hard to get around that foundational principle that we have to assume the jury followed the instructions. For example, in Livingston, now granted, in Livingston is the Michigan case. In Livingston, what they talked about was the officer's testimony was not designed to supplant the role of the jury and reach the ultimate issue, but to address defense counsel's theory that the items recovered from defendant reflected only personal use. And then they go.
The testimony in that case was generalized testimony about common trafficking. It wasn't about the items at issue in the case.
And I acknowledge that. And I also was going to acknowledge one other difference is that here there was no limiting instruction, which we've talked about. But whereas in Livingston, the Michigan Court of Appeals specifically says further, the trial court informed the jury the drug profile evidence is not to be used to determine whether the defendant committed the crime charged in the case.
The testimony is very similar to the testimony that in Ryan Vegas. What came out of the news? Because it wasn't about the facts of the case. It was about general facts.
And I think this case probably got a little closer to the line than it should have, but the state ultimately really believes that one of the elephants in this whole Rael Gallegos, Taylor, Rennick issues is how are we going to balance all this with the underlying foundational principle that we have to assume the jury followed the instructions. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand that there are going to be cases where the jury instructions themselves are problematic, like in the Taylor case that came from Clovis or Portales about 4 years ago with where it was like alternative issues of child abuse and which alternative the jury relied on. But in here, in this case, the defendant is not claiming in any way that the jury instructions were faulty. She obviously is not happy with the outcome, and the state understands that. But one other thing, and then I'm just about done, Your Honor, is that in the Lindbergh case, and I know the judge said that they reviewed it, but in People v. Lindbergh, the California case, they also kind of are really pointing out that as long as you don't say they had that intent, they were guilty, it's generally okay. And in that case, and this was at page 366, I cited it in the Notice of Supplemental Authority, they say the expert stated no opinion as to defendant's guilt or the truth of the special circumstances. In that case, the issue was it was a special murder hate crime, and the expert had testified this guy was a white supremacist. And ultimately, now granted, in this case, it was somewhat similar to ours. The trial court instructed the jurors that they were the sole judges of the credibility of a witness, that they should consider all the evidence on which the proof of any fact depends. So it's similar to this case in the sense that the jury was clearly told, you're the ultimate judges. I only thought Lindbergh was important because the California Evidence Code, Section 805, is worded effectively very similar to New Mexico's, and the Michigan rule is identical word for word with New Mexico's. So at this point, unless the court has any further questions, I think I really made most of the points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I first want to address the state's argument that we can instruct our way out of highly inflammatory evidence in the form of ultimate issue testimony. First, as I mentioned, we already say we can't instruct our way out of this problem in the credibility context, which is another ultimate issue context. Second, look at the instructions themselves. They say, jury, give this testimony whatever weight you want, right? The problem is juries are likely to give it undue weight. They're highly likely to defer to it. An instruction saying, go ahead and do that, isn't going to counteract the prejudice from it. I also think when you rely on instructions, it relieves the proponent of evidence and it relieves the court of the obligation to actually act as a gatekeeper. right? The better approach, and I think, Judge Duffy, you touched on this, is to prevent this from happening in the first place, to be scrupulous gatekeepers of the evidence in the first instance. And so I think that is the better approach. So I don't think we can instruct our way out of it. To the extent he relies on Berry, that was decided prior to Kane. And Kane was a sea change in New Jersey in their approach. They went through and they said, you know, our previous approach was very confusing. On the one hand, we were saying, yeah, hypotheticals that kind of are very close are fine, but you can't talk about guilt or innocence. And then they realized, as they're getting these more elaborate hypotheticals and it's really close to the line, they're like, no, this is all getting to the same point. Juries understand all of this is just saying they're guilty. And so they had to go back and say, yeah, we're overturning those and we're changing it and we're going to follow the vast majority of jurisdictions in saying you get to educate the jury and then you get to leave it up to them to make that decision. And I think in that context, Bolsonaro and I quoted it in the briefing, but I think it's very helpful. They say once Agent Sullivan had testified as to the likely drug transaction-related significance of each piece of physical evidence, the jury was competent to draw its own conclusion as to Bolsonaro's involvement in the distribution of cocaine. We get to educate them, and then we get to let them do their job. And that is basically what I think did not happen in this case, because the expert absolutely testified to that.
I understand that we're really, but once you establish all of that sort of foundation about what in the expert's experience and training is consistent with trafficking and all that sort of stuff, all the, you know, the amount of the drugs, the sales of, you know, money and all that sort of stuff,
mm-hmm.
What can a prosecutor then do at closing argument?
Well, they can make the argument. But that's what they're told. The arguments of counsel are not evidence. This expert's testimony absolutely is evidence, and they are told they get to give it whatever weight they want to give it. That's the problem. That's why we can't instruct our way around this problem.
A prosecutor at that point could say, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, you heard our witness say that this and this and this is all
mm-hmm.
evidence of, you know, trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
You've been educated on that.
And yes.
I ask you to compare what you've heard from the prosecution, from the expert, to what we've actually shown you here in this case, and conclude that the defendant is guilty of trafficking.
Yes.
That would be okay.
They get to make those arguments, yes. I think in terms of do they get to, like, weigh in on credibility and say this person's believable and say they don't get to do that stuff, but they get to say, well, the expert said this is what they use scales for, and scales were found here. The expert said it's, you know, another tool of the trade is a gun, and there was a gun here. They get to use that. They get to talk about the evidence in the case and to make an argument related to that evidence. They just can't go past that. But I think they can tell the jury, we think this together establishes trafficking. That's a fair argument to make. I also don't think it was harmless here, and I just want to touch on that. I think she really was more tangentially related to this transaction. You know, yes, she was there and she was the girlfriend. She wasn't the target of this investigation. And she had, you know, some drugs in her possession. But otherwise, the vast majority of the other drugs were found with him, flushing it down. And everything else, aside from the one gun that was stuffed into a pocket in the suitcase, everything else was in common areas in the hotel room. So she was very, like, there is really a view of this that she is kind of just his girlfriend and a drug user. And I think the expert's testimony, therefore, is particularly prejudicial because it is going to carry weight in a case where the evidence is more marginal. Thank you.
Thank you both. We appreciate getting to talk with you about the case and appreciate your preparation. It was helpful to us.
Thank you.
We are going to take the case under advisement. We'll do our best to get you an opinion as soon as we can. But for today, we are adjourned. Yeah. I need to get rid of my eye twitch.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I saw Brian Patterson.
Yeah, he did.